Jack Dorsey's work at Square, public company, you know, you don't think about that much because it's not Twitter, but, you know, he's still a public company CEO, how his work at Square and at Block is imperiled by Jack's incessant tweeting about RFK Jr.
Welcome to the Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby. It's Thursday, March 7th. Today, I'm joined by Teddy Schleifer to talk about billionaire Twitter founder Jack Dorsey and his flirtation with Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s presidential bid. Dorsey's love of crypto has led him to have a political crush on RFK Jr., but his potential support for the third-party candidacy is causing big boardroom drama at one of Dorsey's companies. Teddy has the scoop. And later, Abby Livingston joins Ben for a post-election rundown of the biggest winners and losers from Super Tuesday. We'll discuss all that and much, much more on today's episode of The Powers That Be. The Powers That Be is supported by Netflix, presenting Ripley, the acclaimed new limited series from Academy Award winner Steven Zaillian, starring Andrew Scott, Dakota Fanning, and Johnny Flynn. Top critics declare everyone is operating at the top of their game in this outstanding series, a masterclass in escalating deceits, deceptions, and a gripping cat-and-mouse game. The Daily Beast calls Ripley's complex tale of murder masterful, sumptuous, and suspenseful, the finest thing TV has offered in many years. It's impossible to overstate just how good this series is. Perfectly realized. Andrew Scott gives a tour de force performance, raves NPR. He's absolutely spellbinding in the series Rolling Stone hails as riveting. Ripley for your Emmy consideration in all categories, including Outstanding Limited Series. Happy Thursday, everybody. Welcome to The Powers That Be. I'm joined today by Teddy Schleifer to talk about tech billionaires and their political fancies. I want to talk about Jack Dorsey's flirtation with RFK Jr. and why he's so into the gadfly in his presidential campaign and why it's causing friction at one of Dorsey's companies. But first, Teddy, welcome. Off the bat here, I want to ask you real quick. The New York Times reported a couple days ago that Donald Trump met on Sunday in Palm Beach with Elon Musk and a few other, you know, rich donor types. You know, this sparked a flurry of speculation on social media that Musk, who is the world's richest man, or one of them, could endorse Donald Trump and give him a bunch of money. Trump obviously needs a little more money than usual because he's dealing with court cases and settlements, et cetera, et cetera. What do you make of this? I mean, is it, you know these people, you know the people around them. What is the likelihood that Elon Musk would get involved in party politics and endorse Donald Trump?
It's very low. Look, the scoop is the scoop, and wish I had had it. I was vaguely chasing it. I'll put it that way. But Elon Musk is a political flirt. He is somebody who has spent the last 3 years, you know, tweeting endlessly about Republican politics and then declined to actually do anything. I'm recalling in the 2022 cycle, around the time he moved to Texas full time, he was going on and on about Texas politics, and lots of people in Republican politics in Texas thought he was going to get super involved in a House race that was out there. He was talking about on Twitter about, should I start a group called the Mainstream Normies Super PAC or something like that? I think he did a poll at one point. Nothing happened. This past cycle, he flirted probably most heavily with Vivek Ramaswamy's kind of allies. I reported middle of last year that Vivek people expected a major contribution from Elon to a dark money group that he had, that Vivek's allies had set up. No donation happened. Elon meeting with Trump to me says a lot about kind of, you know, the radicalization of him and his kind of descent fully into the right wing. All well and true, definitely newsworthy, but I do not think a donation will happen. And Elon today tweeted that he is not donating to any presidential campaigns. You could slice and dice that if you want to, but I think the thrust of it is correct that Elon will not get involved in the general election. And if he does, feel free to play this clip back to me.
It feels like the rich tech guy contrarian set, the very online billionaire class, those types feel like they're more interested in Robert F. Kennedy Jr. You know, not that everyone who, you know, has a hedge fund or a giant tech company and cares about crypto is into RFK Jr., but, you know, these like tech people feel like the two-party system is terrible and we need to change it. And they have these like pie in the sky ideas and they launch these groups every cycle. You've written about this many, many, many times. Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter, now X, has several companies. One of them that he started was Square, which is now Block, because Dorsey has become a big crypto aficionado, big, you know, like pro Bitcoin guy. I saw him at the Super Bowl wearing that Satoshi t-shirt up in the box with Jay-Z.
Next to Jay-Z, his board member at Block.
Oh, he's a board member. Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Dorsey seems very serious about being into RFK Jr. I'm curious why. I'm curious, will he give him money and help him, you know, get on the ballots where he needs to be? And you wrote about this week for Puck. It seems like it's aggravating people at Block, including board members, who don't want him dabbling in conspiratorial politics, who don't want him to support someone who might spoil the election for Joe Biden. What do you know?
Yeah, I some of my favorite stories I've done over my last couple of years are things that look at the tension between Silicon Valley executives' personal passion projects and how that affects their corporate work. You know, I wrote a story a couple of years ago about Mark Zuckerberg's work at the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative being imperiled by what happened at Facebook. Or in this situation, we have Jack Dorsey's work at Square, public company. You know, you don't think about that much because it's not Twitter, but, you know, he's still a public company CEO. How his work at Square and at Block is imperiled by Jack's incessant tweeting about RFK Jr. So the story here is that the Square board over the last couple of months has been trying to navigate the Jack question. I don't want to overstate it. It's not like there was some explosive, you know, fight in a board meeting where, you know, Jack started throwing Bitcoin, you know, USB drives on the table and talking on and on about Jack and, you know, RFK and all that stuff. But like several board members who are, you know, progressive types have left. That is true. They've resigned immediately.
Over this issue.
For a board. I don't want to quite put it that way. I think it is the way I frame it in the story is that Jack has told some people that some board members resigned over this issue and that some board members did indeed have grave concerns about why their CEO was associating so strongly with a problematic candidate like RFK. And, you know, and especially for a company that is, you know, in a very tightly regulated industry. So it's been a source of agita, considerable agita for some people at Square over the last couple of months. Jack at one point was even planning to make a $5 million donation to an RFK group that did not happen, in Jack's retelling at least, because of his, you know, concerns about how it would play internally at Square. So it's actually affecting the campaign. So the interplay that Jack is kind of trying to navigate between the company he leads still and his personal passion project, which is Bitcoin, those two things are tricky. And it reminded me of something that I was talking with a Democratic fundraiser about this morning. When you look at Silicon Valley donors, and I think the same thing is probably true in Wall Street, but in Silicon Valley, the biggest people in politics are usually people who are not active CEOs. They're usually investors or former CEOs or, you know, people who don't have like, you know, naysayers around them and saying, you know, you can't do this for optics reasons or whatever. Like no one's going to tell Reid Hoffman, you know, or Peter Thiel, like, don't donate to this thing because it's going to backfire. Like, who cares? Jack, maybe he thought he was one of those people. Like, he thought he was out of the game, but he clearly is having to deal with issues at Square related to this. And that's sort of what my story shows.
Having known people who have worked at Square, now Block, they feel like not the kind of crypto libertarian evangelist type that Jack Dorsey is himself. They feel more like finance people who, like, made the transition of working for a tech company. So I feel like they're, you know, probably not hyped about Dorsey's RFK flirtation either.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the company, you know, to be clear, I'm not an expert on everything about fintech, but I mean, this is a company that originally was, you know, just selling you know, the plugins that you put in your phone so you can, you know, use your credit card at a food truck. And suddenly it's been, you know, renamed Block, and it's been very much organized around Jack, like the cult of the founder. Like we talked about Jay-Z a second ago. Why did Block buy Tidal, which is Jay-Z's like streaming service? And in part, you know, based on
I didn't know other that still people existed. Supporting.
Yeah, it's part of Square. It's part of Block. And believe me, like shareholders are aware of that because, you know, Block stock is about been totally flat over the last 5 years. So the company is still kind of a weird collection of various Jack interests. And, you know, for employees, like, you know, you might have joined the company because you wanted to, you know, make it easier for the taco truck to take a credit card. But now you're sort of like associated with this guy who's obsessed with Bitcoin. And I know that Jack had, you know, had to field questions about his support from RFK at an all hands meeting last summer, where people said, like, I thought we were a company that was all about like empowering the unbanked and helping with social justice issues. And, you know, I think there sort of is a racial equality focus at the company that I think is not common at other tech companies. And Jack had to like defend, well, really, we're about Bitcoin, and really, we're about making it easier for, you know, underprivileged people to have access to this new digital currency. And like, it is whiplash if you, you know, believe you are working at this company for other reasons. So much so that I know that people at Block, every time there's a new campaign fundraising filings, are like, all right, you know, here we go. Like, time to, you know, see how much Jack donated to RFK this time around. And he's, you know, he's a very interesting leader in Silicon Valley. You know, he is very hands-off. It's almost the opposite of Elon in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And he's checked out. And this is a unique political dynamic that he's going to have to grapple with, because Bobby Kennedy is going to be a big player in this election cycle. Well, I don't think the Jack story is done. Like, he's clearly going to be tweeting things and maybe even donating money if he can figure out how to manage his overlords at the Block board.
I also don't think that the RFK Jr. story is going anywhere. I think you and I have been writing about him a lot this year. And Van Jones actually made a good point on CNN on Super Tuesday evening, where he was sort of talking mm-hmm. about how RFK Jr. is kind of being ignored by the sort of establishment press, literally ignored by the very panel that was covering the election on CNN. You know, they're hyper-focused on who won the primaries, on Nikki Haley, on the uncommitted Biden vote. You know, if Robert F. Kennedy Jr. can get on ballots in key states and get 30% of the Black vote, 30% of the youth vote, it's one of the biggest stories out there. And I'm glad that we are focused on it. And I think people should be paying more attention, not because he necessarily deserves it because of his views, but because he's a factor. And if people like Jack Dorsey are willing to cut him checks, he's a very, very serious factor. Teddy, thanks for joining me, buddy. Thank you for being the billionaire whisperer as always.
You bet.
When we come back, Abby Livingston is here to break down the results of Super Tuesday. Support comes from Netflix, presenting the new limited series Baby Reindeer, the global hit that has hooked audiences worldwide with its singular, surprising, and spellbinding story. Top critics are calling it an autobiographical masterpiece. The New York Times raves, it's astonishing. And GQ exclaims, Baby Reindeer is as powerful as TV can get. Richard Gadd, Jessica Gunning, and Nava Mao give riveting performances. Variety adds, it's a rare gem on television, reminding us what's possible in the medium. And now, the year's most brave and moving discovery has legendary author Stephen King declaring, it's one of the best things I've ever seen. Baby Reindeer for your Emmy consideration in all categories, including Outstanding Limited Series. Are you tired of sleeping hotter than hell? I sure am. I sleep hot. There's something crucial about sleep that eludes us when we're too warm, too uncomfortable, and too caught in the web of our own thoughts to drift off. And while curiosity fuels our days, science tells us that cool sleep recharges our nights. That's where ChiliPad by SleepMe comes in. Meet the bed cooling system that elevates the quality of human life through cool sleep. The ChiliPad bed cooling system is your new bedtime solution. I love it. It lets you customize your sleeping environment to your optimal temperature, ensuring you fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up refreshed. ChiliPad works with your existing mattress. It's a water-based mattress topper that continuously controls your bed temperature from 55 to 115 degrees, allowing your body to rest and recover. This isn't just about escaping the heat, it's also about optimizing your sleep for better health, more energy, and improved physical and cognitive performance, which I obviously need hosting a podcast. Chili pads are designed for one or two sleepers, so if your sleep partner likes to sleep at a different temperature, or you only need it for one side of the bed, that's okay too, and we know that's crucial. Plus, you can schedule automated temperature changes to trigger deep sleep. But when I'm at home, Chili Pad solves those problems. So trust me on this one. Visit sleep.me/powers to get your Chili Pad and save up to $315 with code POWERS. This offer is available exclusively for Powers That Be listeners and only for a limited time. Order it today with free shipping and try it out for 30 days. You can return it for free if you don't like it with their sleep trial. Visit www.sleep.me/powers because you're not just investing in better sleep, you're creating a better life.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Ben Landy here with Abby Livingston. Abby, how was your Super Tuesday?
It was super. It was a good election night. There were surprises. There were results. I love election nights because we spend all these months and years, you know, strategizing, running game theory, and we actually see what voters think and not just what we think voters think. So I love a good election night.
Me too. So let's talk about some of the congressional results, the short-term winners, the big-picture losers. There's a lot to dig into. Obviously, Adam Schiff knocking out Katie Porter in California means he's almost guaranteed to be the next senator there, replacing Dianne Feinstein. But Abby, let's start with the fact that a lot of right-wing Republicans won their primaries. There's definitely been a rightward drift in the likely next House Republican conference. In your analysis, has that changed at all the calculus or your expectation for who actually controls the House next year? Did Republicans, did the MAGA constituency actually make things more difficult for themselves on Tuesday night?
I don't think there's a lot of evidence of that at this point. There just weren't races that were general election campaigns that would influence that. But what I think happened was the fact that Donald Trump was also on the ballot was a big deal. And so there's a very safe Republican seat in Alabama where you had more of an institutionalist Republican member running against another one. And the Freedom Caucus guy won, even though he was outraised by a whole bunch of money. You know, I don't have to get too far into the weeds, but Texas in particular, and there were some unique factors happening there. But I am at the point where I think we should stop using the word establishment to describe what we kind of consider old-fashioned Republicans because they're no longer the establishment. It was pretty close to an electoral massacre for the sort of remaining George Bush-minded type Republicans up at the federal level and a handful of races down ballot as well.
You were also telling me offline, Abby, that Democrats also had a good night because they didn't get locked out of the California jungle primary in one of the seats they're going after. Tell me more about that and if that impacts the sort of national electoral map whatsoever.
Absolutely. This was the most important race on the minds of House Democratic operatives. It's the California 22nd District. I don't know California geography as well as some other states, but I believe this is in the Central Valley. The Republican incumbent running is a man named David Valadao. He's probably Republican's very best campaigner. He was close to Kevin McCarthy, but he's very vulnerable. This is a competitive seat, and Kevin McCarthy was sort of the tentpole of the California Republican Party. Democrats want this seat very, very badly. California races are very complicated because they have a system where the top two finishers, no matter what their party is, move on to the general. And that is very dangerous if you've got a crowded field. And there was borderline panic 2 weeks ago that two Republicans could advance into the general and Democrats would have no shot at this seat. It is going to be a very tough race between David Valadao and the Democratic contender now, Rudy Salas. And so this is a huge victory, but it's just one seat. But I think because of the scale of how happy Democrats are, helps illustrate how, for now, the House map looks like it is going to be a district by district knife fight all across the country, and every single district matters. That could change. The winds and the political climate could change. We might see signs of a wave. But right now, given how Democrats are so excited over a single race going their way in a primary, that tells the story of the House map.
Abby, let's get into some of the Senate results, too. I mentioned in my wind-up, obviously, Adam Schiff is in a good position in California. He very strategically and really sort of ingeniously boosted Steve Harvey, the Republican candidate, in that state's jungle primary, which means he's not going to have to face off against Katie Porter, and he's almost certainly going to win that seat. But also some interesting developments in Texas. Colin Allred, the candidate there for the Democrats, he avoided a runoff election. Is he the next Beto O'Rourke? I mean, does he have a chance in this state where no Democrat has won statewide office since, I guess, the 90s, right? I mean, it's been forever.
I believe it's 1994. So Allred had a good night. He is a Democrat from Dallas. He ran initially in 2018. He was part of that wave. He flipped a Republican seat. And this isn't just any Republican seat. It's the very wealthy Republican donor seat of Dallas. This is where George W. Bush lives. He flipped it. That means he knows what it's like to go through a really hard general election. He knows he's going to get beat up. You know, he actually played NFL football, so he knows how to take a hit. He is raising piles of money. He is outraising Ted Cruz. That is a number one warning sign that an incumbent is in trouble. Beto O'Rourke also did that and lost by 2.7 points. I am in Texas right now. I can tell you the enthusiasm around Allred is nowhere near where it was with Beto 6 years ago in 2018. But Democrats really like the campaign he's running. O'Rourke ran an unconventional campaign, and Democrats are excited about this. But with regard to last night, in Texas, if you do not get 50% of the vote plus one, you have to go to a runoff. And Allred cleared that. He got the same margin as O'Rourke 6 years ago, about 60, 62%. But he did it with a larger field. He absolutely had a better opponent. So he had a good night. That doesn't mean that this race could be competitive in October. I think it's to be seen. But I think the most likely scenario right now is Allred puts up a good fight, and Republicans may need to spend money to save Cruz that they wouldn't spend otherwise. And that's exactly what happened in 2018 with O'Rourke.
I thought it was interesting that Allred was a little bit hawkish on immigration. He took some flack from his left for that position. He's been a little bit harsh on the Biden immigration policy. Do you think that the Democratic consultants nationally are looking at his strategy there and taking anything away from it? Or is that a very specific sort of local tactic, Texas being a border state?
I think it's a bit of border state. And the Democratic term for House members who are vulnerable on the Democratic side are called frontliners. And that sort of posture is a very frontliner type thing to do. But what they really like about Allred's campaign is he's going for the jugular on Cruz in a way O'Rourke really was uncomfortable doing. And central to that argument is O'Rourke going to Cancun during the horrific winter storm where many Texans died in, I guess, 2021. They like that. This is going to be a rough race. And just as a reminder, for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. I have no doubt the Republicans are going to try to tear Allred apart. But again, what's different about Allred than every other Texas statewide contender that I've seen, the next coming of the Democratic Party, is he's been through this before. I've seen many Democrats run statewide in Texas who kind of come off as naive, and they sometimes have glass jaws. So this is going to be a rumble of a race.
Last one, Abby. I want to talk about Arizona. I would have thought that Kyrsten Sinema saying she won't run for re-election would be a big boost for the Democrat, Ruben Gallego, over the Republican, election-denying Carrie Lake. I think she's technically still running for governor, hasn't given up on that one. The Cook Political Report says that this is a toss-up. That sort of surprised me. Obviously, Arizona's been trending more Republican, but I would have thought that Sinema was pulling more support from the blue column, that her stepping out of the way is going to give Gallego a boost. What is your read on the state and sort of the fallout from Sinema's withdrawal there?
I agree with the Cook Political Report right now. I think it's to be seen. We saw some evidence in polling earlier last year that Sinema was actually not playing as much of a spoiler as we thought. I think what is up for grabs here are the McCain Republicans. The Arizona Democratic Party, for as long as I've been watching the state, has been divided between, I guess, what we would call the Freedom Caucus Tea Party types and the John McCain legacy folks. And Sinema was going after that vote. So I don't know. I'm a little agnostic for now. I want to see what the polling looks like now that we have a binary race. But what Democrats will say, they're excited and they think that it will be a boon. But what they're also pleased with is how she exited. It was clean. She and Gallego have been rivals going back to their time in the state legislature. But this was a graceful exit. It was clean. If there are hard feelings, they're not public. And so I think this is going to be a brawl. It's going to be a great race to watch. And I mean, it's game on now.
Any sense of whether the Senate's in play for Democrats in November?
I think Democrats are playing Texas Hold'em and just praying for the right cards to come down. Everything in their control, they're doing well. But you look at what's different this year than past years is, one, how much they're on defense, and two, in Montana and Ohio, you've got very Trumpy states and Democrats who've outperformed expectations there in John Tester and Sherrod Brown. But this is the first time they're on the ballot along with Donald Trump and the voters Donald Trump brings to the table. So I think it's better. I'm just reluctant to make predictions when Donald Trump is on the ballot because he warps things so much, both in his support and how many voters turn out because they can't stand him. But this is why it's dangerous. And I mean, Democrats have to run the table and it's going to be very hard. But Republicans sometimes nominate weak candidates. And we've seen cycle after cycle where Democrats win seats they probably shouldn't because Republicans have put up candidates that are pretty not sellable to the general election voter.
I guess it's a good thing for Democrats that Adam Schiff is in the fast lane in California. I presume that means they've got a lot of extra potential cash to play with nationally that otherwise would have been sunk into a Democrat on Democrat race.
Yeah, there were two kind of theories on that one. House Democratic operatives actually kind of liked the idea of Adam Schiff running against Katie Porter because it would mean two Democrats getting out the vote in November. But I think the larger consensus is he's not going to be running around the country asking for money from donors. He can leave it on the table for other candidates. But what's also interesting here for me, and I don't have a lot of reporting to show, but he's got a lot of money, more than $10 million. I don't have it handy off the top of my head. That's not normal for a candidate who has a safe seat. And what does he want to do with that? Does he want to use it to help other Democrats? And on top of that, Republicans have their effort to censure him only boosted him. It helped him fundraise. And I've gone through his campaign finance reports, and there are hundreds and hundreds of people giving him $5 a month repeatedly. And so it's almost like his campaign is just it's minting money in a way that is very abnormal for someone who's not running for president.
Abby, thanks so much for joining us. This was fun. Great to see you as always. And we'll have you back on soon.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of PUC. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only PUC can offer. Follow us on Twitter at PUC News. I'm Ben Landy. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Odyssey. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of PUC, Bob Tabador, and Ben Landy, executive editor at PUC.